A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Mike Harris from the Gun Owners Action League here in just a minute about the emergency preamble that Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey is attaching to H-4885. The devil's snare, aka the Lawful Citizens Imprisonment Act. Yeah, this emergency preamble put in place by the governor, what, almost 2 months after she signed this bill into law. So where's the emergency? It's not about putting these measures into place right away. It is about blocking this law from being put on hold until a referendum is held in 2026. That's why Governor Healey is now signing this emergency preamble, but it is going to, it threatens to wreak havoc in Massachusetts because, frankly, state agencies aren't prepared to implement this law right away. And so there are a lot of questions and confusion about what is going to happen, both for gun owners, for gun sellers, maybe even for law enforcement, once this emergency preamble has been attached to Chapter 135. We'll talk about that again with Mike Harris from the Gunners Action League just a second. I did want to talk about the vice presidential debate last night for just a moment as well. We did finally get a question. Actually, we got two questions on gun control and the Second Amendment. Did not see J.D. Vance actually hit Tim Walz or Kamala Harris for their gun control views. In fact, I was disappointed. I know that Vance... Listen, he wasn't talking to gun owners specifically, right? You didn't hear Vance talk about, hey, you know what, we're going to stand up for your Second Amendment rights. He was talking to those undecided voters, those folks who are maybe in the middle, who aren't necessarily staunch Second Amendment advocates. They're not huge gun control people either. And Vance's intent, I think, was to tell those voters, hey, listen, I care about public safety, too. I care about kids in schools. Noted that he was a father himself. But said, you know, we have to talk about increased school security. Said you can't wave a magic wand and make all the guns disappear in this country, even if you wanted to. Tim Walz was asked, why did you change your mind on a gun ban? And he said, well, I was talking to the parents of the victims of Sandy Hook that changed his mind. He then bizarrely stated that he has become friends with school shooters. I guess the campaign is trying to clear up that statement. But it was a really odd gaffe, if indeed that's what it was, on the part of Tim Walz. But again, we did not get any substantive conversation about what Tim Walz does support, the contours of the gun ban that both he and Kamala Harris have been calling for on the campaign trail, right? We know that Kamala Harris supposedly no longer believes in a mandatory buyback of so-called assault weapons, but we don't know, for example, how Kamala Harris or Tim Walz would define that term. When they say assault weapon, what exactly are they talking about? Because, of course, California's definition has been revised, I think, four different times over the years. The language in Illinois, different than the language in, say, New York. Senator Dianne Feinstein's federal ban on so-called assault weapons differs greatly from the Go Safe Act, authored by New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich, the gas-operated ban, right, or ban on the gas-operated semi-automatic firearms. So, again, what are we talking about when Walz says that he supports a ban on so-called assault weapons? Which, by the way, he did not actually use that phrase last night. He just said, I believe he said, there are some guns that we shouldn't have. But, of course, we can still protect the Second Amendment, he says. It was... A disappointing exchange. I thought that J.D. Vance had the better argument. I thought he was reasonable. I thought he was common sense. But I was disappointed that he did not use that as an opportunity to not just remind voters, but to inform voters that Kamala Harris has in the past supported bans on handguns in both San Francisco and Washington, D.C. San Francisco's ban would have required existing owners to hand them over to the San Francisco government. Just 2 years ago, she said that the Bruin decision defied common sense in the Constitution. I thought it was a mistake that Vance did not bring up Harris's extreme hostility towards the right to keep and bear arms. I think that could have been done while at the same time, talking about these substantive steps that we can take to improve public safety without infringing on people's Second Amendment rights. So I was a little disappointed in that exchange. And I think it was a wasted opportunity, again, to inform the voters about Harris's long and extensive history of attacking our right to keep and bear arms. But let's talk now about the current attack on our right to keep and bear arms from one of Kamala Harris's campaign surrogates, Maura Healey, the governor of Massachusetts, is stumming for Harris. She's made several TV appearances promoting the Harris campaign. And today she will be signing that emergency preamble that will make H-4885's provisions take effect immediately. Not the training provisions for those seeking a license to carry. The state government, state legislature went back, I think it was last week, very quietly amended those training mandates, delaying them for 18 months. So that portion of the law is still on hold, but virtually every other aspect of 4885 is going to take effect once that emergency preamble is signed. So what does that mean? Honestly, I don't think we know everything it means, because this bill or this law is so convoluted. It is so hard to understand. It is so multifaceted that not only do you have to pass it to find out what's in it, I think you're going to have to see it enforced before we actually learn all of the provisions that will impact our Second Amendment rights. But we at least, again, I think have a rough idea of some of the major areas of concern. So let's talk about it with Mike Harris from the Gun Owners Action League. Take a look and a listen. Mike, it's good to see you again. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Of course. Good to see you too, Cam.
So I'm guessing that neither you nor Jim Wallace or any of the Gold staff got an invite to the governor's signing ceremony for this emergency preamble. Is she even going to have a signing ceremony, or is this going to be done behind closed doors like everything else with H-4885?
I think it remains to be seen. I haven't seen anything about a signing ceremony, so I think my invitation must have got lost in the mail for having one.
You know, I mentioned right before we introduced you that the entire reason Maura Healey is doing this is to stop this law from being paused. You know, Toby Leary spoke, I think, with the Boston Herald yesterday and said they've got over 60,000 signatures. Now, we don't know if those are all going to be approved as valid, but he says they basically got the numbers to, you know, turn in. And under the rules in Massachusetts, if they meet this threshold, I think it's 47,000 and change signatures, then 4885 would be put on hold until voters in Massachusetts have a chance to weigh in 2026. Right. Maura Healey doesn't want to do that, right? So almost two months after she signs 4885 into law, now she says it's an emergency. Mm-hmm. We've got to add this to the preamble. The only emergency is she's trying to stop and is, I think, going to be successful in stopping grassroots activists from putting this law on hold.
Yeah, I mean, for a group of people who is so concerned about democracy as a concept, you know, I think they'd be excited about this one. But, you know, of course they're not.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's unbelievable.
You know, I mean, you and I were talking yesterday. And you said, I mean, it's unbelievable. It's also sort of par for the course, right? When you think about how this particular piece of legislative sausage was made.
Right.
They have bent the rules. They have, you know, gone behind closed doors, limited public input.
Yeah.
Hearing, right, throughout this entire process.
So, so it's just been one extraordinary measure after another when it comes to this bill. You know, when it first was proposed to do this top-down review, they did this listening tour throughout the state. And I don't know. I know we had spoken when that was going on, and it was just, you know, it was a bunch of different stops throughout the state. It was about 12 of them in different parts of Massachusetts. And it was some terrible subject and guns, you know, like it's shootings and guns, suicide and guns, and all these things. They just tried to draw a nexus between, you know, some terrible thing that's going on in firearms. And so, you know, we were working with the legislature at the time to try and, you know, get other voices into the room to have to be part of the conversation. You know, we got panelists on the panel. You know, our own John Green was on there. We got Toby on one of the panels. And, you know, we did all this work with the legislative, with Representative Day at the time to try and, you know, be in the room and be part of the conversation. And then, you know, HD 4420 gets dropped on our laps. And we say, oh, whoa, this is crazy. And, you know, they moved that thing all the way up to, you know, where they could get it. And there was so much backlash initially. And then they redrafted it and then they pushed it out. And they left it as a docket number for all this time and, you know, then held a hearing on a bill with a docket number that hadn't even gotten a first reading and a first review from the clerk's office. And, you know, they called an emergency meeting, joint meeting or joint hearing, I should say, with the House Ways and Means and House Judiciary, and then just handed the gavel off to House Judiciary. Ordinarily, through a legislative session, the House Committee on Ways and Means only has two hearings, and it has to do with the budget. this was an extraordinary measure, you know. So to do that, and then to essentially take a budget bill that had already gone through half of the legislative process, basically take a time machine, hollow it out, stuff this bill language into it, bring it to modern times and pretend it had always been there and give it a new number and then just shove it to the floor for third reading and, you know, final debate. It was outrageous, like on its face. And then, you know, to get to that point, and to get to, you know, the point of having a vote, it took the numbers they had more than anything else, because one of the rules of the Massachusetts legislature is that you can suspend the rules. And if one group has enough votes to do that and there's no one there to stop them, are there really any rules, Cam?
Right. And clearly so, not. I mean, yeah. not when it comes to our right to keep and bear arms.
Exactly.
You know, and that was on the House side, right? And I mean, the Senate has its own history. Senate didn't like the House bill, so then they end up crafting their own. House doesn't like that, so they go to conference committee. They said this was going to be an open process and then shut the doors, right? And so then a couple months later, they come out with this 116-page, I think it was 116-page, 114-page, more than 100 pages. And as I think you and I have discussed, I know Jim and I have talked about this, the way this bill was written, it's not as easy as just, you know, scanning the bill. Okay, here's what it does. You've got to have you've got to have a book of statutes so you can cross-reference. Here's what they're talking about. Yep. As Jim said, when you guys were going through the bill, he said, I started at the top, Mike started at the bottom. We sort of tried to meet in the middle and try to figure out what was going on. But there were parts of the bill that conflicted or said one thing up here, said something different down there.
Yeah.
So this has not been easy to figure out, you know, what this bill actually does. And yet, a day after they drop this Commerce Committee bill, they hold the final votes in the House and Senate. There's no way these lawmakers knew everything that was in that bill when they voted on this thing, right?
Yep. Yeah, not even a day. I mean, the Senate came out with, the House came out with their version. The Senate came out with their version. The Conference Committee version. And, you know, so people had time to read those too. Mm-hmm. But the Conference Committee version looked nothing like either version, like completely divorced. I was joking around, because we're pretty sure that Rep Day didn't write this bill. We're pretty sure it came from, you know, certain gun control advocacy groups. We were joking around. We're saying, you know, the fact that this bill is so different means that this conference committee process is probably the first time that he read it. And said, oh, this doesn't make sense, we need to fix it. And then, you know, in a rush came out with this version. And, you know, it was released on I believe it was July 17th, and they released about five versions before it was finally the final version. And the final one that they ended up voting on came out at 8 p.m on the 17th, and then they scheduled the vote in the House and the Senate for the next day, July 18th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
So less than 24 hours later. Yeah.
I mean, there's no possible way that anyone who was not paying attention had time to read and comprehend this bill. I mean, Jim and I were up till 2 a.m. going back and forth reading this thing. And we got our initial analysis of this bill. We got a ton of stuff wrong because it's like you were saying, it's very self-referential. Mm-hmm. It references itself when it's talking about certain statutes instead of the current version of the law, because it replaces so much of the current language. Actually, I don't know. Has the governor signed the new bill yet? Am I correct in saying current language? I'm not sure at this point.
You know, and does it really matter? Because as you say, they're just sort of making it up as they go along now. So
exactly.
You know, so no emergency preamble was attached to the legislation back then. Governor Healey did not ask for emergency preamble in July when she signed this bill. Right. Again, it's only now that grassroots activists have, I think, been successful in getting the number of signatures they need to put this law on hold. Instead, it's going to be implemented right away. So, Mike, I got to ask you. Mm-hmm. You know, we did talk with Jim. He did tell us that the legislature very quietly amended another bill last week to delay the training mandates for the license to carry, but also training mandates for law enforcement on how to deal with all of the changes to Massachusetts gun laws. Right. The training for retailers has been pushed back 18 months, so they have no idea.
But the requirements on retailers have not been.
Exactly. So all of these requirements for retailers, for law enforcement, for companies like FedEx, shipping guns and ammo to FFLs. Yeah. All of these are now in effect once Governor Healey signs this emergency preamble, right?
Yeah. And not to mention, in effect, for the most important people involved in this whole conversation, the firearm owner. Nobody, I mean, if our team hasn't been able to get this thing completely correct yet, God forbid the average citizen gets stopped by a police officer somewhere. I mean, but yeah, I mean, this stuff all goes into effect immediately as soon as her pen finishes on that piece of paper.
So what are some of your main concerns? Because, you know, again, like the reason why the new training mandates had to be delayed is because the Massachusetts State Police were tasked with developing this new curriculum. They haven't been able to do it. I know the representatives, they said, oh, this is a perfect piece of legislation. Goal is just, you know, making stuff up. It's misinformation. Clearly not. Right. I mean, there was an issue here already that the legislature, you know, reluctantly dealt with. And again, very quietly. Right. Not publicizing it.
Right.
So
it took another group to call us and say, hey, did you guys see this? This was stuck in this bill.
So what are the hidden hand grenades in this bill that are set to go off once it's, you know, now officially in effect?
So there's a couple of things, and some of it, I got to be honest, comes down to interpretation. I mean, so like I said a few minutes ago, I mean, we have our analysis and summary and interpretation of what this actually means, but looking at the black letter statute and what the bill actually says is sometimes can be very different from the interpretation by the executive branch, you know, the different secretariats who are charged with enforcing this stuff. And you know, a perfect example of that is what we saw back in 2016. I mean, so since 1998, there's been assault weapons language on the books in Massachusetts that was interpreted a certain way, so that there were certain firearms in Massachusetts that could be massicized. You know, certain scary features had to be left off. Certain things couldn't go on ARs and AKs and things like that. But, you know, then 2016 rolls around. We had the nightclub shooting in Florida, and then Attorney General Healey reinterpreted the law and sent out an enforcement notice to, you know, as the lead, you know, law enforcement officer of the state, sends out an enforcement notice to her underlings, and says, hey, we're going to interpret the law this way now. So the same thing is at play in this circumstance where, you know, the law says one thing, and we interpret it the way that we interpret it. And we try to be as conservative as possible to keep our members out of jail.
Right.
But you know, the executive branch, the new attorney general is very unfriendly to guns. The new state police colonel, who is the author of all the enforcement regulations in most recently in New Jersey, are the ones who are in charge of, you know, setting forth and promulgating the regulations that are associated with this stuff. So it's all the minutia that's going to make the big differences here. So depending on how, you know, the Executive Office of Public Safety and Security and that secretariat interprets the new roster provisions, we might have nothing for sale at gun shops come tomorrow, you know, because the rosters we have here, the new definition of the word firearm includes all long guns. So since firearms, as that term is defined in the new law, are what are to be included on the new rosters, the fact that there are no long guns on the rosters and they could just erase them and start from the beginning mean that there could be no guns legally for sale in Massachusetts tomorrow.
Yeah, that's what's crazy, right? Because as you say, like, there are no long guns on the current roster. So it could be that, no long guns available for sale until the state figures out this roster issue, right? But as you say, there's also
guns too.
Well, that's the thing, right? Because what if they do decide, okay, well, let's just start the road, build up, you know, scrap the existing roster, build up a new roster from scratch. That would impact all of the handguns that are currently on the roster. And while there is one section of Chapter 135, and correct me if I get any of this wrong, Mike, but there is a section of 135 that says, I think it's three times a year, the state has to update the firearms roster.
Right.
All of these guns are supposed to undergo independent testing and then be certified by the Massachusetts State Police. But there's another section of the law that says the executive, and you're going to have to tell me again that office, the EOS.
EOPS. It's Public Safety and Security.
Okay. So there's another provision in Chapter 135 that gives that secretary the ability to add to the roster whenever they want, right? And they don't
subtract from the roster.
Or subtract from the roster. So they can change that roster at their whim.
Unilaterally. Yeah.
Unilaterally. Yeah, which again, I mean, this is so crazy. And then, you know, again, we mentioned the transportation requirements. Jim said that common carriers like FedEx, UPS, they're now going to have to have essentially a lockbox to store the firearms in when they're being transported. So FFLs, even if they are able to, you know, sell firearms as of Thursday, it might not be possible for them to get new inventory in.
Right.
You know, that's a whole other issue, right? In terms of the common carriers. And then, as you say, gun owners themselves, what changes? I mean, there are all kinds of new provisions about so-called assault weapons, about large capacity magazines. There are rules for residents. There are rules for non-residents. How do we even keep up with this? How do we, and has the state offered any guidance to gun owners at all?
Absolutely. Absolutely not. None whatsoever. But, you know, there's new serialization requirements that we don't really fully understand yet. And that doesn't have any kind of apparatus behind it yet from the state. You know, the state is going to have to start issuing serial numbers for firearms that don't have them currently. And anything that was made after 1968 is going to have to have one. So if you have something that you built or just wasn't serialized at the time, that was made after 68 is going to have a serial number on it. There's also, you know, this new training curriculum that doesn't exist yet essentially puts a moratorium on new license applicants. I mean, that's the craziest thing to me. I mean, it's just nobody who doesn't have their LTC at the moment can really even apply for it without the new training curriculum. There's so much to this, and there's a huge effect on hunting, non-resident hunting non-residents will have to register their firearms if they're coming in for the day just to go hunting. They won't be able to, if you don't have a temporary LTC, which is what we call an out-of-state license in the state, you won't be able to bring a semi-auto with you. You'll be shooting birds with a pump or an over-under. You know, there's a ton to this. The lower tier of licensure, there's the FID, and then there's the LTC. If you have an FID, you can't own a semi-automatic of any kind.
So what happens? That, by the way, is a huge change, right? Because currently,
huge change.
If you have an FID card, you can own these things. But once this new law goes into effect, you can't. So what happens to those current owners?
There's no provision that says what happens to them. They're going to have to get rid of them. That's what it is. I mean, that's the solution, Cam. This bill goes, so the only place where the language is blatant enough where you can understand it is where it calls the registry a registry. Everything else is just backdoor bans, and you know, it's an insane bill. I'm sitting here racking my brain trying to think of the worst parts, but it's all bad, Cam. There's one provision in there's two provisions in this bill that I can think of that are good. If you're traveling through Massachusetts, you don't have to take off your pistol if you have it on you, if you're in the car. If you're just driving through and it's on your person in the car, you're fine. But as soon as you get out of the car, it has to be locked up and secured as per FOPA. And then the other provision is that now if you are in possession of a firearm at the time where you have a 0.08 alcohol ABV, then you're in trouble. We finally have a number associated to it instead of, you know, under the influence like the old law says. But that's it. Those are the only two provisions that I can think of that are even, you know, halfway decent in this bill. The rest of it is a nightmare.
And again, a lot of this, we're going to have to, as you say, we're going to have to wait and see how the language is interpreted by the Attorney General. And frankly, how it's interpreted by, you know, some of these jurisdictions that have typically been more hostile to our Second Amendment rights, because, you know, there is so much local authority in Massachusetts that it really does, in many cases, depend on where you live as to how this law is going to be enforced. Right.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I can say is this is this bill is fertile ground for a multitude of lawsuits.
Yeah. And again, depending on, you know, how these provisions are interpreted and put in place and enforced, I think it's going to be real easy to argue irreparable harm is being done. And this law should be put on hold through an injunction, even if the signature gathering process comes to a halt. I mean, again, if we're seeing, you know, lawful residents unable to purchase a firearm, unable to acquire a firearm, you've got the FFLs who are unable to sell firearms, then our rights, again, are being irreparably harmed every day that this law is in place. So,
I mean, Kim, not for nothing, but we kind of decided a little bit of that back during COVID when we said access to the Second Amendment is just as important as your exercise is tantamount to exercising your Second Amendment rights. Mm-hmm. So if there is no
access, you actually got a good court decision.
Yes. We sued Governor Baker and Attorney General Healey back then.
That's right.
It was 2020.
District Court judge agreed with you that yes, people's Second Amendment rights are being implicated. I don't recall, did the state appeal that decision, or did they just kind of quietly let it drop?
I think they quietly let it drop.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong, but I
yeah, I know. There are so many cases to deal with and to keep track of, but that's my recollection too. I'll have to go back and double check, but I think that there is now, and again, that's not a statewide precedent. It's just one district court decision, but it is something to point to. It is yet another legal argument in favor of gun owners as you guys and other Second Amendment advocates work to not just protect the right to keep our arms, but restore the rights that have been lost here.
Word for it.
That's so,
word for it. Restore.
Well, listen, I want everybody to make sure that they're checking out gold.org. You guys are doing a fantastic job of keeping the website up to date. And again, there's a lot of stuff that's just in flux. I wish that we had firm answers But just as, you know, Mike has talked about throughout this entire process, this has been designed, it seems, to be as confusing as possible right. to those who are impacted by this law. So it is going to take some time for this to shake out. And Mike, I look forward to having you, Jim, and all the folks from Gold back on the program here. We are definitely going to be paying close attention to what's going on in Massachusetts, but I really do appreciate you joining us today.
Yeah, of course. Happy to be here. This is great.
All right. We'll do it again
happy
soon.
To talk about it.
Hey, thanks, right, Mike. Thanks, Karen. Thanks to Mike Harris for joining us here and looking forward to having him back again very soon. In fact, we may end up talking about what's going on in Massachusetts on tomorrow's show as well, just because we might have a better idea of what exactly is being impacted here. So we will continue to be paying close attention to everything that's going on in Massachusetts. And who knows? Maybe they have a conversation on Thursday's Cam and Company as well. Right now, though, let's turn our attention to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, as well as our recidivist report. And we'll start there with a case out of Baltimore. Now, it's not the suspect in this case who is the recidivist. Instead, it is the head of Maryland's Department of Juvenile Services who keeps doing the same thing over and over again. And as Fox 45 in Baltimore reports, some residents are now calling for his resignation after one of the suspects in an attack and robbery of a 66-year-old man was released to the custody of his guardian. This brutal attack captured on video, 18-year-old Montez Bailey was one of the suspects. He faces an attempted murder charge as well as robbery charges. There was a 15-year-old who was also arrested in this attack, who, according to Fox 45, was released to his guardian just a couple of hours later. Now, may still be facing charges, but he's not in custody. He's been sent back home to his guardian. Arch McCowan saw the attack, actually captured it on video, shared video of the attack with Fox 45. He's now calling for the immediate resignation of Vincent Schiraldi, who's the head of Maryland's Department of Juvenile Services. And he says many of his neighbors feel the same way, that he can't step down soon enough. As Fox 45 reports, not the first time that a juvenile was released shortly after their arrest on a brutal attack. Last November, the same neighborhood, a woman was assaulted and robbed by a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old who were apparently also released to their guardians. Last week, the two were back in court and got probation for the attack. According to Fox 45, Vincent Schiraldi has long said he is opposed to probation and thinks that someone should not be sent to prison before the age of 25, which begs the question, what does he think should happen to juvenile offenders who commit horrifically violent crimes? He doesn't like probation. He doesn't like incarceration. So what's left? Again, I guess sending them home to their guardian or their parents for a stern finger wagging and a grounding, maybe community service. Listen, I'm all in favor of, you know, taking troubled teens, make sure they've got counseling, make sure they've got resources. The goal of the juvenile justice system is supposed to be rehabilitation, not just incarceration. I understand that. But again, there are some of these defendants who are a danger to themselves and others. They are a danger to the community. And the safest place for them and for the public is to be in a secure facility while they're receiving that counseling, while they are getting the help they need to try to turn their life around in the juvenile justice system. Checking in with a probation officer once a month, even once every 2 weeks, it's not the same thing. But again, if Schiraldi thinks that probation goes too far and incarceration should be off the table until you're at least 25, begs the question, what does he think should happen to these repeat violent offenders who are under the age of 18? And right now, it looks like the answer is not much at all. Today's armed citizen story from Birmingham, Alabama, where police, actually prosecutors, say the fatal shooting of a man at a convenience store over a alleged Facebook beef was in fact a justified use of force. And we don't have a lot of information about this case. 26-year-old Malik Williams was killed back on September 24th, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon at the Big Boy convenience store on Pearson Avenue South in Birmingham, Alabama. Police at the time said the shooting possibly stemmed from a dispute over a social media post. Officer Truman Fitzgerald said last week that police believe two adult males were involved in an armed confrontation with one another. One party had a gun. The second party had a gun. One of the males fired shots. But after presenting charges, or at least evidence, to the Jefferson County DA's office, prosecutors determined that the shooting was justified. The ninth justified homicide in Birmingham this year. Again, we don't have a lot of details on the circumstances of this particular shooting. The victim's name has not been released, and that's okay. He's the victim of a crime. But I'm hopeful that prosecutors and police will at least provide some additional information about what led to the death of Malik Williams and why prosecutors believe that this was a justified use of force. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Yes, another story of heroism from the Hurricane Helene devastation. In this case, a teacher from North Carolina who broke out her kayak and an axe to help save some of her neighbors. Maddie Allen is a high school math teacher. She's now in Raleigh, but she lives or lived in the town of Swannanoa. She said she was watching out her backyard window as the rain was coming down and the floodwaters were climbing up. And she said, the next thing I know, I hear screams of help. She said the water was up to her neighbor's gutter. She said, I saw a man climb out of his window to get onto the roof. She said it was like something out of an apocalyptic movie. It was just insane, she says. So she said she put in a kayak. She said, couldn't even find a paddle. I took a snow shovel and was trying to get to this other house. I wasn't thinking, wasn't planning. She was joined by her husband and another neighbor. The three took a kayak, tied it to another one, were able to get the small kids out of the house and off the roof. She said eventually they just started putting people in life vests. She said they were hanging on to the side of the kayak. They were able to take them back to higher ground in Alan's backyard. She said, my husband brought an axe. He was axing it into people's roofs because they were stuck in their attics, and the water just kept going up. She said, at one point, there were certain houses you could just see the little tops. And they're all single stories. She said, our backyard neighbors had a basketball hoop. We used that basketball hoop as a metric to see that it was probably at its highest point. Again, just absolutely terrifying situation. And we are going to hear so many stories of neighbors just coming to the aid of neighbors, people coming to the aid of complete strangers, doing the right thing. And that certainly sounds like it was a case for Maddie Allen, her husband, and her neighbor, who helped evacuate others to safety from their Swannanoa homes. I know that life has forever changed for so many of these folks, but in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing to save lives. Maddie Allen, we thank you for your very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Don't forget to check out Bearing Arms throughout the day today, keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from across the nation and beyond. Ryan Jensen has a great take on the armed citizen who stopped a terror attack in Israel yesterday, just before Iran launched its ballistic missile strike on the nation of Israel. We've got more legal updates for you, and of course, we'll be watching everything that's going on in Massachusetts as well. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, do well. Be safe. And be free.